State v. Hayes Johnson, and Ms. Herman, Assistant Attorney General, will argue representing the State of Wisconsin. Ms. Herman.
Thank you. May it please the Court, I am Assistant Attorney General Laura Herman, representing the State of Wisconsin, the petitioner in this matter. I would like to start out by doing two things, by providing the State's position on the central issue in this appeal, and then by defining the key terms in an effort to aid the Court's understanding of the State's argument. The central issue in this case is whether a presumption of prosecutorial vindictiveness applies when a prosecutor adds charges following a mistrial caused by a hung jury. A critical question in addressing this issue is whether the hung jury mistrial situation is more analogous to the pretrial plea negotiation context addressed by the United States Supreme Court in the cases of Bordenkercher and Goodwin, or whether it is more analogous to the post-conviction appeal situation addressed in Blackledge versus Perry. The State's position is that no presumption of prosecutorial vindictiveness applies when a prosecutor adds charges following a mistrial, when the mistrial is caused by a hung jury. In that situation, there is no realistic likelihood of vindictiveness. A mistrial that results from a hung jury is not caused by the defendant. The defendant does not cause the need for a new trial and has not caused his conviction to be overturned because there has been no conviction. Therefore, our position is that the mistrial hung jury context is more analogous to Bordenkercher and Goodwin.
You treat it as if there'd never been a trial.
Right.
Go back to pretrial conditions. I mean, that's your theory.
That's our theory, yes. Now I'd like to...
Hasn't the defendant, in some sense, if it were anyway, caused the hung jury by simply insisting on his right to trial?
He did not cause the hung jury. The hung jury was simply the result of the jury's inability to agree. I mean, he didn't do anything that necessitated the need for a mistrial to be declared. If I could, I would like to just briefly tell you exactly what the State means by the terms prosecutorial vindictiveness, presumption of vindictiveness, and actual vindictiveness, because I think it will aid the Court in the course of this argument. Prosecutorial vindictiveness is a legal term of art with a precise and limited meaning. The term refers to a situation in which the prosecutor files additional charges against a defendant in retaliation for the defendant's exercise of a constitutional or statutory right. Now, there are two ways in which a defendant can make a prima facie showing of prosecutorial vindictiveness: by demonstrating a presumption of vindictiveness is warranted, or by showing actual vindictiveness. And a presumption of vindictiveness applies when the circumstances create a realistic likelihood of prosecutorial vindictiveness. Actual vindictiveness, on the other hand, requires direct evidence that the prosecutor acted in retaliation for the defendant's exercise of a legal right. The State asks this Court to reverse the decision of the Court of Appeals and find that no presumption of prosecutorial vindictiveness applies under the facts of this case because there is no realistic likelihood of vindictiveness.
Ms. Herman, let me ask this. I ask myself as I'm looking at this case, why does a prosecutor do this? Why does a prosecutor afford this? It seems to me that one of the primary reasons, aside from being angry, you know, prosecutors angry, is because the prosecutor, at the time either of filing the information in which the prosecutor adds more counts than were originally in the complaint, or in this kind of situation, is attempting to increase the risk to the defendant in order to induce a plea. Assuming that I'm correct, is the effort to increase the risk to the defendant vindictiveness under the law?
No, in fact, the U.S. Supreme Court has addressed that situation, not necessarily in the context of a mistrial caused by a hung jury, but the U.S. Supreme Court in Bordenkercher specifically held that a prosecutor's actions in filing additional charges to induce a guilty plea is entirely proper. There's nothing inherently wrong with that procedure.
Well, now, in this case, and that's, you say mistrial is a sort of a blank. You just wipe that off the slate, so you're right back before your trial. But here, pretrial, in the first trial, what charges were made?
The charge initially made was one count of first-degree sexual assault.
It. First trial, only one count, right? One count and all the documents.
Right.
Okay. And the prosecution was willing to go with that and offer a plea agreement, right?
Yes.
Okay. Now, there's a mistrial. And the prosecution, and I'm really sort of stretching Justice Babbage's question, and I think it'll point to you. Now you got a mistrial, and the prosecutor didn't want to try it to begin with, and for probably very good reason. You have two young girls here, right? And the question is putting them on the stand, and that child has not only been traumatized by this alleged sexual offense, now the child is traumatized by having to retell it, right? And that's the fear. So the prosecutor doesn't want to do that for good reason, let us say. And that's what the prosecution is saying. That's what your statement is. So now they've had a trial and it didn't turn out the way the prosecution intended, so now they're bringing a second charge. And all of a sudden, you've upped the ante. It's not like the first pretrial case. Because in the first trial, the state thought it was good enough to go with one count. Now, for what reason does the state come in with three felonies?
Well,
that's what the fact situation is here.
Right, right. Well, our initial argument is, we don't get to that step unless the presumption applies. It's only if the presumption applies that the prosecutor has to provide a non-vindictive explanation for her actions. However,
but by just telling the story, it seems to me, says there's something the matter here. Doesn't smell right. Doesn't pass the smell test.
Even if.
Unless you say, well, they discovered new evidence, or can't think of something else, or that you had a prosecutor that was ineffective and you had to fire him and he was just handled all the cases badly and the state now is fixing up what was a terrible mistake to begin with. I mean, but if you can't find an excuse, it just doesn't smell right. First time it was good enough with one charge, now you got three.
A prosecutor is entitled, I mean, under the prosecutor's discretion, he or she is entitled to assess the situation, reassess the facts,
absolutely.
Reassess, and decide whether or not additional charges should be brought, and that's exactly what happened here.
But why? Why did you bring additional charges?
Well, the explanations that are in the record at this point. Initially, when the prosecutor filed her motion to amend the information, she explained that she thought that the evidence supported these three counts, and the jury should be able to consider the charges because that's, you know, what the evidence most. Those charges are all supported by the evidence, and that was her initial. Explanation in her motion. Then in her brief in opposition to the motion to dismiss, she explained that the state had reassessed its presentation of the evidence, taking into account additional witnesses that developed between the first trial and the second trial, and also due to the development of the case during the first trial. And she felt that the jury should hear the three charges because they most accurately fit the evidence that was presented by the state. And her argument two, which is essentially what Judge Sykes agreed with, was that we're back in a pretrial situation and the prosecutor had discretion to add these charges initially, and so that's where we find ourselves. That's where we find ourselves now. The intervention of the mistrial does not defeat
and
that.
Your argument, though, is, if I understood your brief, is that you didn't want the children to have to testify again.
That seems to be a theme running throughout everything that has happened in this case as far as the prosecutor's action. By looking at the record, that theme comes out several times, that is her desire, is really to spare these child victims, or the child victim and her sister, who was also a witness, from having to testify at all, or certainly from having to testify again.
Counsel, you don't need any new evidence, as I understand. It can simply be a change of, as you indicated, trial strategy. You know, each side strategizes what they are going to do, and it's my understanding that whether you come up with the explanation that after you had listened to the witnesses, which is kind of, that's unique in itself. You don't normally get to do that.
Right.
You know, when you choose, what am I going to charge, what can I prove, and then after you go through and you have a mistrial or hung jury, you've had that opportunity at least. But we're not talking about necessarily new evidence. It can just be a change in trial strategy. Do you disagree with that or agree with that?
No, in fact, several of the cases from other jurisdictions that have addressed this specific context, the mistrial caused by a hung jury, have, you know, basically said that's fine. And other cases have held that there is no vindictiveness, some cases go so far as to say even if the prosecutor just made a mistake in failing to charge these originally, or certainly if it was just a reassessment of the facts of the case. And certainly in this context, when the first trial ended in a hung jury, it isn't just the state that benefits from having had the opportunity to go through one trial. The defendant benefits too. The defendant has had the opportunity to see exactly what the evidence is that's going to be presented against him. So both parties essentially get to reevaluate and reassess how they're going to present their cases.
Let me ask you this. How does the idea of overcharging fit into the idea of vindictiveness? What I'm concerned about is this. I was on the trial bench for 19 years, and I never remember a situation under circumstances similar to this where a burglary charge was brought in addition to the two sexual assault charges. I understand the burglary involved, the allegations of burglary involved entering the room to commit the sexual assault. Strikes me that that's really overcharging to bring a charge such as burglary. How does that fit into the idea of vindictiveness?
Well, I don't think it does specifically in this case, because it's not part of the claim that the defendant in this case has raised. He did raise a specific, in his motion to dismiss, he did raise specific grounds related to the burglary, saying that none of the evidence presented at the testimony at the preliminary hearing didn't really support that charge. But Judge Sykes ruled differently, and so there wasn't a claim related to vindictiveness dealing specifically with the burglary charge. And in fact, as you know, the defendant was not convicted of that burglary charge. But overcharging isn't specifically a component of this. The defendant is really only complaining about the addition. It seems to me is only complaining about the addition of the second count of sexual
assault.
Well,
how about not in this case specifically, but just generally, if you had a situation where it appeared that there had been overcharging, wouldn't that seem to support the idea of a presumption of vindictiveness or actual vindictiveness, either one?
Overcharging in and of itself, no. If it could be demonstrated by the defendant that there was a realistic likelihood or direct evidence that that charge, which the defendant is claiming, you know, was overcharging, was filed by the prosecutor in retaliation for the defendant's exercise of a particular right. That's what the defendant would have to show, because in vindictiveness, that's what we were talking about. We're talking about retaliating against the defendant for exercising a constitutional or statutory right. Overcharging in and of itself may fall under some other context of prosecutorial misconduct, but not in and of itself within a claim of prosecutorial vindictiveness.
Well, following up on Justice Babbage's question earlier, when you've got a situation where it appears that what is going on is an attempt to force a plea bargain, isn't that an attempt to override a right of the defendant, the right to a trial by jury?
It certainly is a prosecutor's desire to try to, the prosecutor is trying to induce the guilty plea. However, the U.S. Supreme Court has spoken on this in Bordenkercher and later in Goodwin clarified that and said that there's no vindictiveness involved in trying to induce a guilty plea. So that situation has been specifically addressed. A prosecutor can try to induce a guilty plea. Our society, our criminal justice system, favors or certainly tolerates plea negotiation. It's considered a legitimate objective, and the desire to induce a guilty plea on behalf of a prosecutor is also considered to be a legitimate prosecutorial objective, and courts, I think, have unanimously agreed on that,
I'm not sure that is all good law today, given what has happened in the legislatures around the country. What concerns me, there's a fundamental concern that I have with this. When I was a prosecutor or Justice Posner, somebody committed a theft, usually had one count for a violation of 943.20. But with the actions of the legislature, it seems every interest group has got a special theft statute, just as an example. And now a district attorney, instead of charging one count based upon one act, can charge three, four, six counts. And obviously that's done to, at least not obvious, I guess, but it sure strikes me that that is done to induce a plea, to get the defendant to give up his right to trial because you have so systematically upped the ante. You have the state is using its power greatly increase the risk. And a lot of the law that you cite is from the old days when I was practicing. I'm bothered by that ability of the state now to overcharge in ways that we never used to be able to.
Well, specifically in this case, I don't believe there is anything within the Wisconsin statutes that prohibits this, and I don't believe there's any case law that prohibits the charges that were brought in this case. And also, there's been no argument by the defendant at any point in time that these charges were not supported by probable cause. He has never argued that there wasn't probable cause to bring these charges at all.
And two charges of sexual offense arising out of the same incident is authorized by this court.
Yes, exactly.
That would be not legislative. Our interpretation, right?
Right.
So you could have charged 10 probably if there were
questions. If there were 10 different sexual contexts, yes.
10 different touchings, right. If we should hold that this conduct is a prima facie showing of prosecutorial vindictiveness, what effect do you think it would have on plea bargaining on the initial charging?
Well, I think the impact would probably be prosecutors bringing every possible charge that could be charged on in a potential situation up front and then using those to try and plead down to something else. And here we have sort of the opposite.
You have overcharging initially.
Right, and then say, look, I'm charging these 12 counts, but I'm going to give you a really good deal and I'm going to let you plead to this one instead of here where the prosecutor filed legitimate charges that were supported by a probable cause and then engaged in plea bargaining in that way. There's really, I think that's what would happen if it's very easy for a defendant to make a prima facie showing or if it's extremely high burden for a prosecutor to overcome that, that's going to be the net result. Prosecutors are going to charge every possible thing that could come out of these particular circumstances up front for fear that, well, if we don't do it now, we're not going to be able to do it later because a court is going to find that we've acted vindictively.
So you increase the risk on the defendant, and then you say to the defendant, now you're subject to 120 years in prison. and under the truth in sentencing, you get 120 years, or whatever the court gives you out of that 120, and so you better plea bargain. And if they don't, then you can go to trial, and maybe the one or more of those grounds could be proved. If there's a mistrial, then the prosecution can start again with the 12 counts.
Sure, as long as they were all legitimate counts supported by the evidence, which is what we have in this. This isn't a situation where a prosecutor is bringing essentially bogus charges in order to try and induce a guilty plea. There's no question that these were legitimate charges supported by the evidence in this case.
So if you want to cut down a prosecutor's overcharging, in quotes, that is piling it on, you'd hold the state in this case.
Right, and what we are specifically asking is that this court, we believe that the Court of Appeals incorrectly applied a presumption of prosecutorial vindictiveness. We are asking this court to reverse that decision and find that no presumption is warranted under these types of circumstances because, as I said earlier, the defendant has not caused the need for a retrial, has not caused the mistrial, and has not caused his conviction to be overturned, which were the concerns of the U.S. Supreme Court the U.S. Supreme Court had in the cases where they found fit to apply this presumption.
Well, now, let's suppose we agree with you that there's no presumption of vindictiveness.
Right.
Does that end this case?
It does not end this case. Then what would have to be determined is whether the defendant has provided any direct evidence that the prosecutor's actions were done to retaliate against him for exercising a constitutional or statutory right. And in this particular situation, the defendant has not made a prima facie showing. Mr. Johnson has not really made an argument specifically related to actual vindictiveness other than saying this case smacks of actual vindictiveness. The defendant has not shown specific direct evidence that that was what the prosecutor's motivation was in this case, to retaliate against him.
Was there a hearing?
On the defendant's motion to dismiss the amended information, there was a hearing, and at that hearing, the only argument the defendant was really making was that no presumption of vindictiveness applied. But the trial court, Judge Sykes, did go so far as to say, I'm familiar with this case, I've read the case law, no presumption applies under these circumstances, but also there's no vindictiveness.
Was the district attorney called as a witness?
She was not specifically called as a witness. It was just a motion hearing where I think each party presented.
The district attorney saying something very inappropriately publicly so that the defendant has those words to hang on, like, boy, I really want to get this bad guy. How does the defendant ever prove vindictiveness without the benefit of a presumption?
It is extremely difficult, and the courts have acknowledged the fact that, the U.S. Supreme Court and most of the cases that I've come across dealing with the notion of vindictiveness say that it is extremely, exceedingly difficult for a defendant to prove this because it may be that there isn't direct proof. There may not be a statement by a prosecutor to that effect or a letter or something. But there may be circumstances where the defendant does have something to make that direct, to make a showing that there is direct evidence that that was what the prosecutor's motive was. And courts, including the U.S. Supreme Court, have not seemed to find a problem with the fact that a defendant may have a difficult time in meeting this burden of showing actual vindictiveness.
What if the prosecutor had 10 additional charges?
All proven in the evidence, all subject to the record, that they could get the evidence from the record. 10 different touches, 2 burglaries.
Our position would be the same as long as those charges were legitimate and only if the defendant, there would only be vindictiveness under the same circumstances here if the defendant can show a realistic likelihood that the prosecutor filed all those charges to retaliate against him for exercising some right, or if there is some direct evidence that that's what the prosecutor was doing. The number of charges in and of itself is not enough to show vindictiveness.
But what about a presumption that can be overcome? Would the defendant be entitled to a presumption anyway? All of a sudden he's facing 10 charges instead of one charge?
Again, I don't think the sheer number of charges warrants a presumption. It's the nature of the right of the defendant that poses the need for a presumption of vindictiveness. It doesn't deal with the charges specifically brought or the number of charges. It has to do with, is this the kind of right exercised by a defendant that a prosecutor is likely to retaliate against him or her for? And unless a defendant can show that, the number of charges doesn't specifically make a difference.
And you're not influenced that the right is a right to trial.
Exactly. Lots of courts cited in the brief, lots of those cases have found that right in and of itself is insufficient to even warrant a presumption of vindictiveness.
What about a rule that said on recharging after a mistrial, the prosecutor can only charge the same offense or offenses or any lesser charges that came out of the evidence?
I don't think that would be an appropriate rule under the context of vindictiveness because a prosecutor has the opportunity to reassess his or her case, and if these charges are legitimate and the evidence supports them, I don't think that there should be a rule limiting to the prosecutor to certain specific charges or to ones
that would interfere with prosecutorial discretion.
Exactly.
Is an executive branch right in the separation of powers issue.
Right, right. Thank you.
Good morning to the court. Good morning, Chief Justice. My name is Russ Bohack. I represent Hayes Johnson in this matter. The problem that we have fundamentally with the prosecution for the state's position is that they want a blanket rule. That's what the federal court cases say. In a hung jury mistrial, you can never have a presumption of vindictiveness. You must show actual vindictiveness. And what I feel that does is that takes away from the trial court the right to think. Exactly what we're doing here today, talking about, well, let's look at the whole circumstance. Let's see what happened in the trial. Let's see what the interaction between the attorneys were during the trial. Is there a possibility that the prosecution may be irritated with defense counsel, and that may be a basis? The trial court has the unique ability to take a look at those types of things. If we say there can never be a presumption, we take that ability to think away.
Well, you still can show actual vindictiveness, Mr. Bohack.
But it's much more difficult. And as has been said here, absent somebody saying, I'm doing this because I don't like you, it becomes extremely difficult to prove actual vindictiveness. It's easier to prove a reasonable likelihood of vindictiveness. The facts may show that. And the point that I want to make here is that we are not in a pretrial setting. This isn't the setting where prosecution has an unfettered right to charge whatever they want, subject to probable cause. This is different. After the mistrial, we are not back in the same position for a couple reasons. One, in this case, he was only charged with one count of first-degree sexual assault, and in fact, up till the day of the trial, and I believe the March 15th letter from the prosecution is part of this record, the offer was, if you plead, we'll drop it down to a second degree.
Counsel, just maybe explain why isn't the prosecutor in the same position? It was always my understanding that after a hung jury mistrial that things started over again, and you weren't committed one way or the other. So why isn't that as the original? In other words, with the discretion of the prosecutor being allowed.
But truly, you're not in the same position.
No, that's what I meant. Why not?
Well, for one thing, after the mistrial, at this stage, he was facing more counts. And fundamentally, the defendant may have testified.
No, but he was facing more counts because the prosecutor chose to include those accounts for whatever reason. And we heard your opposing counsel discuss perhaps some of the reasoning behind that. I asked, well, can you change, based on what you heard, trial strategy? Is this whatever? No, you're saying no, you can't, as I understand.
I'm saying that if you say absolutely there's no presumption, then we can never get to that analysis. If you say, yes, there could be a presumption, then the prosecutor can say, I changed my trial strategy. I did this because the defendant got on the stand and admitted A, B, and C, or there's new evidence, or I looked at the defendant and I thought he was a lousy witness, so I think now I can go get him better, or the young lady that I put on the stand was such a wonderful witness that I don't think it would hurt her to talk about two or three different charges that happened in there. If you take the state's position, we can't make that analysis. It's taken away from the trial court to make that analysis. And what I'm saying is, let the trial court do that. If the circumstances show that there's a reasonable likelihood of vindictiveness, then let the trial court decide whether or not it exists. Make the prosecution come up there and say, there was a new prosecutor. I made a mistake. There's new evidence. The witnesses look better. But that's all taken away from us under the state's position, because the federal court cases say, as a matter of law, you cannot have a presumption in a mistrial case. And they base that upon the fact that they believe that the mistrial hung jury is analogous to the pretrial situation. And I disagree with that.
Are you saying then that if the prosecutor in this case was to come back before the trial court and say, look, during the course of the trial, I realized that I had a stronger case than I thought I had, which happens. You know, you think the witness is going to be lousy and they're good. And therefore, I thought I could go further than I had originally. Is that sufficient to overcome the presumption?
Maybe. And I think what I said in my brief was, it's circumstantially determined. One reason may be good enough in one case. It may take five reasons to overcome the presumption in another. And the language of the presumption statute essentially says you have to put forth enough evidence to rebut the presumption. Simply saying that my witness was better may be more than enough in a certain case. Simply saying that there's new evidence may be enough. There may be such a taint of vindictiveness because of the actions of the prosecution during the trial or during the motion hearing that it may take two or three reasons to come back and say, no, you, or yes, you have rebutted that presumption. Again, though, this is the analysis that I want to happen. This is what Mr. Johnson wants the court to do, to see if there's any explanation, because I've submitted in my brief that there's absolutely nothing on this record from which you can determine that there was any reason that this prosecutor didn't charge this a year earlier or 6 months earlier or 9 months earlier.
Let me give you what I see as a problem with your analysis. What you're doing is interfering with the discretion of the prosecutor, which we accept fairly much in the cases, that the prosecutor has broad discretion. And what you're doing is saying that broad discretion looks vindictive, and all you have to do is show reasonable likelihood. And just stating the facts here, you say shows reasonable likelihood, right? So what we're going to do is have mini trials, evidentiary trials. Every time you've got a hung jury and there's a new charge, and it may not be a hung jury, there may be other things that would permit recharging after various forays, and then that will all look to prosecutorial vindictiveness. It seems to me that the prosecutorial vindictiveness is an executive, that is, prosecutorial discretion is executive, and that this court has held a number of times that if you don't like what the prosecutor does, you have every 2 years you can vote him out of office. Right?
Correct.
So why go into all of this? If I have a second thing, you know, you are correctly arguing for your client, and your client has been found guilty now of two sexual offenses instead of on jury on one. But I think you're taking a position, or you're asking the court to take a position that's very anti-defendant. Because what prosecutors will do initially is just pile on the charges, which will induce more plea bargaining because the risks get higher for the defendant. Right?
That's possible.
That's at the front end. Then at the back end, it seems to me, on the second filing of the information, that what you're doing is, in effect, warning the prosecutor not to give you a plea agreement. Because if they start giving you plea agreements, you wouldn't have a case, I don't think, if they piled on more charges and they didn't plea bargain with you. They'd say, hey, I'm adding charges, no plea agreement, no deal, we're going to trial. That's your prerogative. So I think what you're doing is limiting plea agreements for defendants at the back end and piling on the front end, and therefore, in total, you're asking the court to be very harsh on defendants, and probably maybe the end result is eliminating all plea agreements in the state.
Let me go back to the first question. You indicated that this might be a limit on prosecutorial discretion, but we do that after a successful appeal. So it's not unheard of that we limit the prosecutor's discretion. And on the front end, they have unlimited discretion, which goes to the Chief Justice's question regarding adding on charges. Well, as a defendant, I would rather know up front what I'm charged with than go through a whole trial, put myself on the stand, and then on the back end, get those charges piled on. At least I can make a strategic decision with 20 charges facing me. Do I testify? Don't I? And I think that's much more in favor of the defendant than to say, I'm going to trial on one charge. I put myself up there on the stand, and now on the back end, I'm facing 20 charges. But I've already testified. I put myself out there. Maybe I wouldn't have done that on the front end. Sure, there's a possibility that prosecutors will try to pile on as many charges as they can. They do that now. They're subject to the overreaching. They're subject to the probable cause. They're subject to the jury. I just find it a much better proposition if they do it in the middle on a hung jury mistrial, that the defendant then has the opportunity to say there's something wrong with you doing it then. Under the state's proposition, they could do exactly what the Chief Justice said, pile it on in the middle, and the defendant, absent an actual vindictiveness showing, can never challenge that. Because the rule says you can't have a presumption. You can't think about that. The interesting thing is here, in a sense, the defendant, in this case and in that scenario, the defendant is actually better off, even if it was 11-1 for acquittal, saying, never mind, I'll just convict me, because then I only have one charge, and now I've got three. I mean, that's the kind of rights. There's a fundamental right here where the defendant is placed in a very difficult position. And if he, and actual vindictiveness is extremely tough to prove, although I think this case comes as close as I've seen. But if you take away their ability to even argue that there's a presumption, I think you're taking away all of their ability to sit there and say there's something wrong with what happened here. And in this case, I know Justice Fine talked about, well, maybe we leave for another day if there wasn't the letter that went out and said, well, if you now plead, we'll go back to the original. I think the analysis has to be made whether there's an offer of a plea agreement in between or not. The analysis has to be made, is there a reason legitimately on this record for the prosecution adding the charges that they did?
So your position is, unless the same charge is leveled, or a lesser charge?
I don't even know if a lesser charge. I'm saying unless you are back to the original position of one charge or two charges or any charge.
Well, suppose they charge second-degree sexual assault.
Instead of first. Oh, then I have no problem.
Okay.
I'm asking you.
So if the state brings the exact same charge or brings only a lesser charge, then it's okay. But if they bring a greater charge or charges in this situation, then you want the court to say that there's a presumption of prosecutorial vindictiveness.
Only if the surrounding circumstances, as the Chief Justice said, the smell test says that there's a reasonable likelihood. If the prosecution, in filing their motion to amend the information, says the little girl got up there and gave six new facts that weren't in the prelim, weren't in the police report, weren't anywhere, and this is why I'm filing it, it's an open and shut case. There's no realistic likelihood. But here there was no, the best explanation that was given was, I don't want them to testify again, which is an improper reason to plea bargain.
Why is that improper?
Well, in the sense that I believe that Justice Fine indicated in his, Judge Fine in his brief that sparing the child from another round of testimony in State versus Gilbert is not necessarily a proper reason for offering somebody or taking away the right to a jury trial by use of a plea bargain. I believe that was the case he cited, and that was the proposition that he made. And that was the best they could come up with. And if this court follows our argument, all we're going to do is go back to the trial court and say to the prosecution, tell us why you did this. Give us an explanation.
You say on these facts there was a presumption of vindictiveness. Suppose Mr. Johnson had accepted the plea offer and pled to one count of child sexual assault. That doesn't change the nature of what happened here. Could you attack the conviction afterwards?
I don't believe so. I believe he would have waived any constitutional rights that he would have had by entering the plea after the mistrial and accepting the plea bargain. I don't think he would have had a right.
Wait a minute. Judge Sykes said, no, there's no vindictiveness here. He could have, I think, accepted the plea bargain that was offered at that point.
Correct.
Why couldn't he have attacked the conviction?
Because by accepting the plea agreement, he's pleading guilty and agreeing to waive his constitutional challenges. That's part of the general colloquy between the court and the defendant. And there's certain rights that aren't necessarily given up when a guilty plea is entered, but I believe attacking the charge upon which you're pleading guilty is probably one that he would have given up when he entered the plea.
One of the problems I have is I look at a pretrial situation. And sometimes in a pretrial situation, you have multiple charges on what could as easily be the charges as a single incident. But we say, okay, that's prosecutorial discretion. And in my sense is maybe they do that because they want a conviction. Isn't that same kind of reasoning appropriate for post-trial, not just pre-trial? Why is there a presumption that they're doing it in an vindictiveness to punish for the exercise of some kind of a right? They want to get a conviction, pre-trial, post-trial. I'm being a little loose now, but more emphasis.
Well, in a sense, I mean, post-trial appellate, the presumption always applies. So we've gone that far. I mean, where we are here is in a narrow situation that has never been addressed by this court, and that is the mistrial situation. And what I'm saying is that it's closer to the appellate standard than it is to the pretrial standard because things have happened. And I, as a practical matter, we can sit here all day and say nobody caused a mistrial. But as a trial attorney, I've never seen a prosecutor happy with it, and I've never really seen a defendant unhappy with it. They feel that they've gotten some kind of victory by getting one or more jurors on their side. So the prosecution is generally mad. The defendant may have testified. It may alter the entire trial strategy of what would happen if new charges are added. So it is different. And I think at that point we have to put some limits. And those limits are, they're not onerous. They're not going against the discretion of the prosecution. They're merely saying, give us a valid reason. And I think they should be able to do that. But a valid reason. And it may be as simple as, I've changed the trial strategy. The witnesses were better. It may be a different prosecutor. It may be some small scintilla of evidence. And as I pointed out in this case, I didn't find anything. As a matter of fact, there was actually less evidence of two assaults at the trial than there was at the prelim and all the intervening motions that occurred. So we're not taking anything away. We're just saying there's certain circumstances in which your actions have to be justified. And this is one of them.
Mr. Bohack, are you satisfied with the remedy that was crafted by the Court of Appeals, sending this matter back for an evidentiary hearing, perhaps vacating the second conviction, letting the first conviction stand unless there's a showing that evidence could not have come in that otherwise came in as to that first count?
Partially, mostly. I think the appropriate remedy is to go back and hold the evidentiary hearing, and if that's the determination that's made that it's vindictive, then we vacate the second sentence because that should never have been there. The analysis regarding the first is somewhat difficult. I can see what the Court of Appeals is saying in terms of, well, the evidence would have come in anyway. But as a trial attorney, I also recognize it's harder to fight three charges than it is to fight one. Your strategy is a little different. The jury has three bad things in front of them instead of one. So my position is, in fact, because the prosecution was allowed to go forth and force the defendant to meet three different charges, there's a taint there, and I don't know whether we can overcome that. My position is that taint stays there, and therefore we vacate everything. We go back to where we were had they not filed the amended information, which is we tried the first. Which would have happened if they hadn't been allowed to file the amended information.
Or you get a chance to plead to an amended charge.
I'm sorry?
Or you get a chance to, if your client gets a chance to plead to the first offer.
That may well be. And there's certain strategies that are involved in that too. But I think the court has seen where we're coming from. And all we're asking is that the trial court be allowed to think.
Well, if I read both briefs properly, if there is any case that supports your position, it'll be a loner case, that is, alone, the vast majority, maybe all the cases, support the state's position. Is that right?
I believe so. If somebody could find one, I'd like to know about it, and I'm hoping that this is the one.
Okay. And does it bother you asking that this state be the only state? You think it's the first, but only first of many.
It may be first of many. I think depending upon the analysis that this court makes, and part of the analysis is that all of those cases say that there's no reason for a prosecutor to be mad after a mistrial as a almost a rule of law. And I quite frankly disagree with that. And I pointed out why I think that is. And especially, And especially in this kind of case, where we have young children with a sexual assault, where the prosecutor has to go and retry that a second time with very young children, there's a real reason why the prosecutor's mad about having to retry that. So the basis of all those other cases, I think, is a false presumption, and that is that prosecutors are never mad after mistrials, or that there's nothing bad that happens to them after mistrials, and I think that's erroneous.
But you're asking us as a matter of law to presume that the prosecutor is mad.
No. I'm saying that if the circumstances that the trial judge sees when he or she gets the motion to amend the information, because that has to be done by motion, if when that is presented to the trial court, they have a year or 6 months, they have a trial, they have a lot of interaction between the attorneys, if when they get that, they believe that those circumstances show a realistic likelihood of vindictiveness, then they apply the presumption and a hearing is held. If the court feels, wait a minute, this is perfectly legitimate, there's no realistic possibility because of A, B, and C. And see, unfortunately, in this case, Justice Sykes didn't say A, B, or C. She just said the federal courts say there can never be a presumption, therefore I'm not applying it. So I like your analysis. If the trial court thinks and says there's a realistic likelihood, we have a presumption, we have a hearing. If they don't, they put on the record reasoning why they don't think there's a realistic likelihood, and we never have a problem in the appellate courts.
But in this case, there would have been under your reasoning, there would have been this likelihood because the state made no offer when it amended to explain its amendment. Is that the point? And at the hearing for dismissal, you don't think they made a sufficient enough showing?
I don't think they made any showing.
Okay. They made no showing. So therefore, under the facts alone, charge, hung jury, upcharge. That's enough. If the state doesn't explain, that's enough to raise the presumption, a rebuttable presumption.
Right? I believe so.
And the state would have to show by a preponderance of the evidence?
To rebut the presumption, the statutory preponderance.
What's wrong? Would you find acceptable a rule that simply says following a mistrial, in the absence of newly discovered evidence or other objective reasoning, the prosecutor can't add on any more charges?
I would like that.
Right rule, right line.
I mean, I think that would be an acceptable rule. I mean, in reality, I'm probably going a little further. I'm saying that we can't anticipate every circumstance which may engender upping the charges. I'm saying let the trial court make that decision on the basis of the totality of the circumstances. It may be something that we didn't think about here. It may be something that's unique to that case. They have a right to do that, but they have to show why.
My sense is there is a blanket sort of approach here. I think you're saying that anytime there's a mistrial and there's an increase in charges, that there is, that's tantamount to a prima facie showing of vindictiveness. Rebuttable, of course, but that's your rule. Anytime there's a mistrial and there's an upcharge without more, that's all you have to do as a defense attorney, and there's a prima facie showing that there's vindictiveness subject to rebuttal to the appropriate standard by the defense. Isn't that what you're asking for?
That's what I'm asking for. I'm saying that in reality what the law says is there has to be shown a realistic likelihood of vindictiveness for the presumption to apply. I believe upping the charges without explanation after a mistrial is a reasonable likelihood of vindictiveness.
That blanket rule, and all you need is that, and it's a prima facie showing enough to get you into court on the issue of vindictiveness.
If the trial judge believes that, I'm saying that I believe it is. I'm saying that the trial judge still has the ability to say, wait a minute, even under these circumstances, I saw something that would allow me to believe that this isn't a realistic likelihood. I was at the trial, therefore I know what the evidence was. So there's an out there. It's a nice blanket, but it's not complete. And that's what I would like.
Could I ask you, what may the prosecutor legitimately do
to forestall the 5-year-old victim from having to testify again?
Unfortunately, that's a very difficult question. Sometimes it's not charged. Sometimes it's charged something that the defendant will take. In this case, the original offer was to go down to a 10-year felony. And he didn't want that. I mean, sometimes if you charge something, you take your victims as you find them, and you have to proceed with that.
Well, there may have been video conferencing if you could have shown adequate grounds for that. Might have had some other techniques, testimony that might have spared the victim. All of these raised problems for the defendant, and you probably would have objected to his defense counsel. And they may not have been adequate showings with children of this age, or they may have been. But that's a basic problem when you've got a child, or even an adult victim who's been subject to physical or sexual abuse.
That's the difficult part of this case, and in a sense, that's why the prosecution feared a mistrial more than almost anything else, because it created a second trial, which created more of a burden on the victims in this case, and that's unfortunate.
Hasn't the law in this state fundamentally changed by the enactment of the Victims' Rights Constitutional Amendment? It seems to me one can posit the concept of defendant vindictiveness, and that is, this little kid is testifying against me and trying to put me in prison, and I'm going to force her to go to every single hearing I can. It seems to me now there is a duty on the part of the state to protect that victim against that kind of vindictiveness, isn't there?
Well, I think there certainly is, but the defendant has a constitutional right to a jury trial, and that's what he proceeded with here. And unfortunately, the state's the only one that can spare the victim up through the trial, and that is to decide to reduce or dismiss the charges. And that's why, in effect, the state has to go to the victim now and ask, what would you like to do with this case? I mean, they don't have to listen to them, but if they want to reduce the charges or dismiss them, they have to have the victim's approval to a certain extent. But unfortunately, you're right, the defendant has a right to make the state go through every hoop. And that's part of the Constitution, and that's why we do that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bohack. Ms. Herman, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Sure.
I liked your brief. When you were discussing what we should do with this case, whether we determine a presumption of vindictiveness or not. And it seemed to me, correct me if I'm wrong, it seems to me that you are essentially espousing the Lefebvre middle ground approach. Is that what you are?
Yes, in order to overcome a presumption or a prima facie showing, yes.
But isn't another way of stating the Lefebvre middle ground approach this, that in the absence of an objective reason, such as the discovery of new evidence, additional charges after a hung jury cannot be brought? Isn't that essentially Lefebvre's middle ground?
The middle ground approach comes in only if a presumption applies in the first instance, and here no presumption applies, so we don't even get to that step of determining whether the prosecutor had an objectively reasonable explanation for her conduct.
Well, what is wrong? Let's forget presumptions and all that. Let's just say that the rule in this, what is wrong with a rule in the state of Wisconsin that says after a mistrial, a prosecutor cannot bring additional charges unless the prosecutor shows objective basis for doing so?
There's no basis for that law at this point in time, and it would go against the great weight of the authority in other jurisdictions that have addressed this kind of, I mean, no other state that I'm aware of has crafted such a rule regarding mistrial situations.
But, you know, Mr. Boca made a very good point. I've never known a prosecutor that was happy with a mistrial, and I've never known a defendant that was unhappy with one. Do you agree with that?
Well, that's a point I'd like to touch on, okay. In fact. This isn't about who's mad at someone or who dislikes someone. That's not vindictiveness. The very first part of my argument this morning was, what exactly is vindictiveness? It's a very precise, limited term with a very precise meaning in the law. And it has to do with retaliating against a defendant for having exercised his or her rights. It's not just, boy, I'm mad because this, you know, now look where we are. I really don't like the defendant or the defense counsel. That is not enough for there to be vindictiveness or even a presumption of vindictiveness to apply. It's beyond just dislike or disagreement or unhappiness with the circumstances. So it is more than that. And another thing, along with that I would just like to point out, it seems to me that opposing counsel is losing sight of that very fact, that he wants a blanket rule that a presumption always applies in this situation, but the way the law is now and has existed, I think the notion of prosecutorial vindictiveness has been around since the early 1960s, I believe, was one of the first cases in the United States Supreme Court. A presumption of vindictiveness only applies if they're, again, coming back to this notion of retaliating against a defendant for having exercised a particular right. He has not demonstrated anything. The circumstances in this case just do not lend themselves to a presumption of vindictiveness. It deals with the nature of the right asserted by the defendant. Is that kind of right the type of right that a prosecutor is likely to retaliate against a defendant for having exercised? And most of the courts addressing this situation as far as a defendant's right to exercise, a defendant's right to go to trial, is not that kind of right in and of itself that is likely to cause a prosecutor to retaliate against the defendant for doing that. I guess I would just like to summarize briefly some of the points here in this case, and that is that the state's position is that no presumption of prosecutorial vindictiveness applies under the circumstances of this case because the defendant didn't cause the need for a retrial. The defendant didn't cause anything to be undone, which is the type of situation the U.S. Supreme Court has applied a presumption to. When a defendant exercises his right to appeal, he caused and is successful, he has caused his conviction to be undone. It's that type of situation that is likely to cause a prosecutor to retaliate for having exercised that kind of right. There have been no cases that have really held a presumption to apply under the circumstances of this case. Therefore, we would ask that this court reverse the decision of the Court of Appeals. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. That concludes our hearing on state media.